Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Screenwriters Rewatch from the Script Department, a show where we've gone rogue. Yes, you've heard that correctly. This week, we'll be talking about classic 80s nostalgia, Flight of the Navigator, where we will see whether or not we sneak this into the Script Department vaults hidden in the Trimaxian drone ship. Today, I'm joined by Lorna as we let Sarah Jessica Parker help us into the robotic assistant lab facilitator, lovingly called Ralph, on the NASA base to rewatch Flight of the Navigator. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe, and check out our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can always pop over to the Script Department website to see what's going on with our global network of screenwriters. This was a film that was the backdrop of my childhood, and I haven't watched it for years, despite watching it a million times when I was a lot younger, and it's great back. But Lorna, I think this is probably a very similar story to you, is that right?
Yeah, I absolutely adored it. It's one of my favourite films. That and Batteries Not Included are both films that I've watched again and again, and would like made sure I got hold of copies to be able to show them to my children. And I just adore it so much. And that's why it breaks my heart so much to watch it as a screenwriter.
It's really tough, isn't it? Yeah. Actually, when you look at it in a really critical way, you've realised why this isn't perhaps quite as iconic as films like E.T. But it is really hard, and it's quite interesting to pick apart why we have such a love for it, even though it wasn't a rip-roaring success, and it also doesn't really tick all the boxes in that screenwriting sense.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a bit of a painful episode, I think, for us. But we had a little chat over on YouTube and a little bit in between about how there's still a lot of heart in this film, and there's an interesting reason I think we've come up with why this still ticks a box. And why we still think it's a good film.
Yes. So back in the 80s, there weren't really many films with children as the main characters. So E.T., which you've mentioned, is one. And Flight of the Navigator is another. But things like Back to the Future, adults or at least older teens as being the main characters. Many of the classics, they had adults still as being in the main character, presumably because, you know, they're a bit more reliable than children. Having children on set trying to get the long hours of filming sorted was difficult, so they just went with, let's just have adults. And also, you know, it's adults writing it, so adults writing from an adult perspective, because that's what adults know. And this is probably an example of why you can't always be writing what you know. And so because it's got this kid as being the main protagonist, it really did capture the imagination. And he's a great actor. He's absolutely brilliant. And so then therefore...
He is brilliant. Yeah. I thought that as well. Just watching the emotion when he realises his situation. So it's Joey Cranmer is David Freeman in this as the protagonist. And it is a stellar performance. Yes. And I'll talk a bit later about the relationship with this film and some other things, especially Stranger Things. But I definitely got Eleven vibes when he was in the hospital gown, and it was very emotional. They even have very similar facial features, I think.
Yeah, you're right, just being able to
pull out that emotion was, as a parent now, heartbreaking. Just kind of, that's so real.
Yeah, the parents do such a great job as well. Like, the way that you see them so carefree and having so much fun together, so carefree that they don't really pay attention to their children and how to, like, resolve the conflict properly. and then when he comes back to them 8 years later, they are so haggard. They are so broken by their experience. And it's really only, for them, it's only a day or two since they were filming the scenes of that were so fun. But they look so much older. They behave so much older, like they've been through 8 years worth of trauma and loss. And then to be finally reunited with him in this strange circumstances, and that you can feel their, like, confusion, but also their joy, is they just
they do wear it well, don't they? I think they wear that time apart well. I think bringing up that family connection and the relationship, they have that strong kind of family vibe. There's some things that I think, you know, you mentioned about Batteries Not Included and E.T., and Batteries Not Included is definitely one of those other films that I watched, along with Short Circuit. And I know Short Circuit is more about sort of sentient robots rather than aliens and UFOs. But there's a link in that sort of the characterization of Max in this.
The innocence, isn't it, that he has, when especially when he downloads all of David's memories and he becomes very human.
So there were a lot of films around that time in the 80s where they really played with this idea of technology, of the future, of of that making contact. And I felt, rewatching this, that there was a lot of Spielberg-esque characteristics in it. That it was family-centred, that it was an ordinary boy in an extraordinary circumstance. The epic music score that Alan Silvestri did was just perfect, I thought. It was very, very good and played into that Spielberg vibe. And I don't think it was... I think it was very deliberate to put in there when David lands at the gas station, and he's, you know, the attendant sort of just says, he said he just wanted to phone home. And
that's brilliant. I love that.
Kind of, that was a definite nod, I thought,
to E.T.
What do you think? Do you think it was trying too hard to be like an E.T. film?
No, I think it's just showing the love. And I think they, because there aren't many similarities, are there? But I think it's definitely a kind of a nod, a doff of the cap towards E.T., which, you know, anyone with love, loved it then, love it now.
Yeah, I think when you think about the journey, that the antagonistic journey with NASA chasing the authorities, chasing them down, and the boy hiding, effectively hiding this alien away until he can let go of him. That journey is very mirrored. And I wonder if perhaps this was too close to E.T. for it to be separate. I think I preferred this film over E.T. When I was growing up.
Yeah.
I don't think I could tell you any particular reason why, but this is definitely a more playful, fun film, whereas E.T. felt a little heavier.
Yeah, I mean, because the tone is different, isn't it? This is definitely more comedic, and E.T. is definitely more dramatic, and the connection that they feel with E.T. is I suppose, you know, I've never really thought about them being very similar, because to me they're just so
I suppose it's the tone, and I've just, in my brain, I've just put them in two separate compartments, and, you know, it's an alien rather than a spaceship, so therefore that's obviously different. It's funny how it's when you're watching things as a kid and how much you can compartmentalize things and just never compare, and then you become an adult and do screenwriting, and then suddenly it's like,
Well, that's it, isn't it? If you'd asked me a week ago what was this film about, I would have said it was about a boy and an alien spaceship and, you know, time travel. But rewatching this critically, you understand, with particularly with David's want and need, that it centres around the relationship with his brother. And in the beginning, in the opening scenes, it's a very fractured relationship. They're always fighting. Yeah. They don't like each other. You know, they're really quite malicious to each other in that very nuclear family way, because it's, you know, it is a very white American family in the 80s that are middle class. So they are as antagonistic to each other as I think they're going to be in that sort of scenario. But for then David to find himself in the future and alone, and his younger brother is now older than him and is almost in the role of the parent, and David is sort of he's lost his authority, he's lost you know, sort of any right to be the older brother in that way, and then meets Max the alien on the ship, who, or the sentient AI, I guess, he is able to fulfill that role and be that big brother, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. He does learn to kind of take control, which he's not doing with his younger brother. He's just kind of snickering at him.
Yeah,
but yeah, he does take control. So maybe that is part of his arc. It's taking control of his life and the relationship, and becoming that kind of authoritative figure that he maybe needs to learn to be,
and understanding how frustrating it is to be the one without the power. So when they're falling from the Earth's atmosphere, I think what is works out something like 2,000 miles per hour, I think, if it takes them that long, and which is insane. That, you know, he's, Max just shuts off and he's like, well, if you're so smart, you can work it out. You know, if you're going to be horrible to me, then you get on with it. And that's the kind of thing that he probably would have done to his brother. He would have behaved, he would have you know, talked to him in that way. So for him to sort of have to sort of be that younger brother and understand that placement and that role, and what did you, would you be able to look back, like, before you rewatch this, would you be able to have said this is a film about a boy and his brother, or would you have described it in a different way?
Well, because he doesn't see his brother much, I would mostly be focusing on the aspirational wish fulfillment of flying around in a spaceship. And that really, I think, is probably what I connected to as a kid much more than anything else. And it's hilarious having an alien spaceship talking like a human being. I mean, that's brilliant. So, yeah, I think it's all those things that made it, like, feel like a connection for me, more so than the storytelling.
Yeah.
I'm so sad. Don't make me say it. Don't make me say it, Helen.
And I think, because it's hard to remember when you're a kid and you're watching something, what are you watching it for? And for anyone writing that sort of young, that young adult, or maybe not young adult, but maybe those that are writing for those younger age groups, yes, it's, you need to have that story arc in there, but to be able to capture the imagination of your audience, to be able to, you know, give your audience the feeling of what it's like for David to be in a spaceship, you know, like you say, that's what captured it for you when you were a child. And I think that playfulness, and, you know, an alien life form isn't a serious, like the NASA guy, you know, really, Dr. Faraday was really serious and miserable and only interested in scientific progress and the threat to Earth and all of that boring stuff. Whereas actually the alien was, you know, once he'd done the brain scan on David, it was almost a reflection of a persona, a more likable, relative, childlike character. and that breaks down a sort of it's a misconception, isn't it, that an alien is going to be super intelligent and therefore just present themselves in a really serious, boring way. So I think you're right. I think that's the thing that's captured us, especially back then. And I think as an adult rewatching it, I would still say that that's what interests me now, is that this alien is super intelligent and super advanced, but he's a relatable, likeable, playful character.
Yeah, definitely. And there are certain things that they, because the want doesn't present itself until he's been abducted and comes back, there's the opening scenes which can only really discuss the need in terms of the relationship between him and his brother. There's the, sets the tone with the frisbee flying through the air and it looks a bit like a spaceship. And then there's the blimp that goes over. That's the kind of a bit of ominous music.
It's very foreboding, isn't it?
Tonally, it's going, so it's trying, so it does what it can to set the tone and it does what it can to set the need, but the actual want obviously can't happen until later. It's same with Back to the Future, but the Back to the Future leaves it much later before he finally does end up in the past. Whereas this is, I think, it's the first 10 minutes. That's all. The first 10 minutes of the film is the introduction, and then
1978.
And then after that, he's in the 1986. So that's, so they do get through it. It's like, bish, bash, bash, we need to get there. So that, right, now we know that he's out of place and what he wants is to get back home. And then even when he gets back home, well, it's not really home, and it's all out of place because he's stayed the same and they've moved on. And so so it's the kind of storyline and plot that you can't, you have to do that, you can't do anything else. So they do their best to kind of set the tone and give you a sense of what kind of story you've got, rather than it just being a family drama where it's just annoying little brother.
Yeah,
there is going to be more than just that going on.
Sort of thinking about the story structure and that, and in particular the midpoint. So the midpoint, David gets onto the ship. That is exactly the midpoint, and that is the point of no return. Effectively, he's made a decision and off he goes. How did you feel about the sort of the story structure leading up to that midpoint? Did you feel that it was sort of inevitable, or that there really was a choice that he was making at that midpoint?
It's all a bit of rushed to the point of him, right, let's go on the spaceship, because I don't think he knew that the spaceship was there. When did he know that the spaceship was there?
As he's arriving on the first day, he is sort of hears.
Yes, he does communicate with it a bit. Yeah. He does hear voices, but he doesn't know who it is.
No.
And so it's not really a want of his. He just happens to turn up there and then go, oh, okay. So again, it's like this kind of just short lead up to each of the choices that he makes, but they are choices he's making. So he chooses to leave, but it's Ralph that takes him to the spaceship. He has no idea where so Ralph is the little kind of robotic food delivery, well, it's a little truck, isn't it, but it's very small, but so he squeezes into it, and so Ralph then just delivers him to the next port of call, which just happens to be where the spaceship is.
I don't know how they did the programming of that. That was a bit of a plot hole for me. I thought, you know, has she programmed that to, no, because he just gets in it, doesn't it? It had nothing to do with Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah. Although they do have a conversation. He does tell her that he wants to get out.
Yeah.
And that he asks her to help him get out. And also he asks her to speak to his mum and dad. And then Ralph turns up without her. And so he makes the assumption that that was all part of her plan.
But I hadn't actually thought about whether that was a deliberate thing, but I did notice that she wasn't with Ralph and thought, you know, well, that's odd.
Yeah.
But I hadn't made the connection that maybe she just didn't want to be associated with it and had gone to see his parents so that he could. But yeah, there is that, the getting from his room to the hangar. I mean, that's clearly where he wanted to go, because he stood at the window and had a conversation with Max. Telepathy, you know, sort of telepathy. and then got into the, so maybe Max reprogrammed it, or
yeah, that's true, it could have been Max, couldn't it, that kind of drew Ralph to,
I mean, how epic is maybe that scene though, where little Ralph is like going down the slipway and there's like a big truck and all the music,
yeah,
is
absolutely
80s,
yeah,
and epic, and and there's,
yeah,
convenient,
yeah, yeah,
for David to look through,
yeah, yeah,
that's quite funny. But yeah, I the reason I brought up the midpoint was because it felt like sort of from the moment he arrives on the base, he hears the voice, and you know, don't you? You know from that moment, mm, that they are going, there is going to be almost like an obligatory scene between them. They will become,
yes,
they will get together, yeah, and then yeah, for him to sort of talk to him, sort of telepathically. And then, mm, you know, sort of go to the base. You know, he arrives at the hangar, mm, and he sees the spaceship, and it opens, yeah, and it's kind of, it feels like an inevitable, it doesn't feel like he's making the choices to go there. He's just sort of swept, yeah, along with it. So
yes,
again, that's,
yeah,
fed into the idea that he's quite a passive protagonist,
yes,
and that these are events, yeah, that just happen to him, and he's not making, yeah, any effective choices,
yeah,
the only choice he does,
yeah,
make,
he makes choices in the moment, but he doesn't have any particular plan. Obviously,
no,
he wants to go home, so that in the second half of the film there's more of a, right, okay, we're together now, I want to get home. So at that point he's like, okay, I've got a vehicle and I've got a plan, and I just need to, so then he negotiates with Max about, okay, so I'll give you the star charts, which, I mean, really could have, I mean, they got put in without his consent, so presumably they could be taken out without his consent.
Yeah.
The computers were managing to take out all, yeah, the information from his brain without his consent, apart from just a conversation. So presumably Max could just as easily take the star charts out of his head without consent. So yeah, but still he manages to negotiate an agreement, and which Max is happy with, you take me home and I'll give you the star charts. And so therefore that's then something that they're doing together. And it is amusing, the fact that he doesn't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale. I mean, I wouldn't know how to get to Fort Lauderdale if I found,
no,
myself in a spaceship. So
I did think it was quite clever that they'd moved house, because it meant that,
yeah,
you know, David being the navigator, as it were, because he's got the alien star charts in his head, mm, but doesn't, mm, know where his family live now.
Yeah,
that did make,
brilliant,
it quite interesting. Whereas if they'd been in the set, he would just been easily been able to get home.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know,
or
that
more easily.
A,
it doesn't mean
a,
that he knew where the NASA base was compared to where his home was either. So
no, exactly. So, and you know, I think I can't imagine most 12-year-olds would be able to pinpoint too much of the geography, especially not from the air. You know,
yeah,
maybe I'm doing 12-year-olds a disservice, but I thought that was a good way of throwing in a turning point, an antagonistic turning point of, actually,
yeah,
I want to go,
yeah,
home, but neither of us know, so I'm gonna have to get a map, and then,
mm,
we're gonna have to work it out, but I still don't know exactly, yeah, where that is. So he's got to contact,
yeah,
his brother and, you know, get him to,
yeah,
make this signal. Yeah, so that in that sense that did work. Was there anything for you that didn't particularly work? I know that's a really difficult question to ask you with such an emotional film.
Yeah, I think the heart of it, and the kind of the relationships with the parents, and the you know, their protectiveness of him, and him them saying absolutely not to having him prodded and poked by NASA, but then them turning him around with, well, I'm sorry that you don't want any answers. I think that was a really great emotional moment, because as a parent you would say absolutely no, but then the desire for answers, you can see it as being compelling. So I thought that things like that really, really worked. It's just the kind of threading through of the goals and the want throughout the whole script. And Yeah, and then it's a really quick, like, what is the third act? Is it literally just that him, like, saying, getting to his parents, going, actually, no, this isn't really my home, and then, okay, let's go back, let's try going back in the past? Because that's really, like, I think it's something, like, well, it's, if it's 10 minutes, then that's about, that's definitely the maximum it could be in terms of that final denouement of the film. And it's, so it's not very long, is it? It's just like, oh, bish bash bosh, here I'm home, I'm happy, my parents are happy, and they have no idea of all this heartbreak that that they had experienced in this other life. So yeah, it's all, it is all just a bit quick, bish bash bosh, there you go, tied up with a bow. All they needed was the girl that he liked to just kind of turn up and go, hi, and him go, hi, and be much more confident this time.
Yeah.
And then that would be everything, all tick, 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 tick.
Yeah, so the beginning of the third act is after he's phoned his brother, and it, you know, it sets up the next, that next active question of how is he going to find his home? So, which is,
so he's already got the maps,
so he's he picks up the map, I think, when he
at that same point,
and the crunchy bar, which every time I look at a crunchy bar, I always think about this film and him eating the crunchy bar while he's eating the map. So I can't ever, I've never been able to look at a crunchy bar in the same way. And crunchy bars are different in America to in England. So the the third act does set it up, that active question. So as it goes for the active questions, it's quite good. The midpoint is quite good. The need is there, but isn't particularly strong. The want
doesn't appear particularly explored. It's
the beginning of the second act, really, does it? And those are the sort of flaws with it. And we talked very briefly in the YouTube video before this about the antagonistic forces that are present, particularly in the second half of the second act, which is the time that David is on the spaceship and he gets to know Max. What are your thoughts around the presence or the absence of those forces?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's very much just wish fulfillment, isn't it? I mean, so much of it is just like, you got an alien spaceship buddy who you can just fly around, turn up to Tokyo, have people taking photos of you, and getting to be in the cool spaceship. And because there's no risk at all, as far as the NASA people getting hold of them in the ship. It's just the fact that obviously it's the family side of things, and the fact that they get to the family and that's where he wants to go. I mean, how it took them so long to figure out, oh, he's going home. No way! Considering the fact that you promised him that he could go home and you lied to him.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't shoot him down either, which I think probably would have entered, especially with what's going on in the news at the moment about unidentified flying objects being shot down. But it does strike me, you know, this isn't just happening in America, this is happening around the world. You know, he flies to several places and the world aren't taking an interest in this, and there isn't you know, no one's attempting to follow him around in a, you know, a fighter jet.
United Nations have a chat, apparently, don't they? I mean, there is reference on the news to the United Nations being like,
what's going on with this? But that is it, isn't it?
Otherwise it's just a NASA bug.
That's it. And they are only trying to find him. They're not, there's no, there isn't kind of
they want their spaceship back so they can prod and poke him and prod and poke him, and that's really all that they want. Which and at no point do they have any idea that they're being jerks.
No. Do you think it would have made a difference if they were, okay, they're posing a threat to national security, let's shoot them out the sky, so we'll fire on site. Do you think that would have made a difference to how that, and that particular part of the second act would have played out?
Maybe.
Or if Max had...
But then it would become a very different film.
It would be a different... Or perhaps if Max had been a little bit like, well, actually, I've run out of time now and I need to leave, so you can either be set down here or you know, in 1986, or you can come with me back to Phalon.
you know, if Max hadn't, if he'd,
yeah,
sort of, I don't know, if there was a time constraint or something on that.
Yeah, there needed to be more, really, didn't it? Because otherwise, because the thing is, as a viewer, as a kid, I was just like, yeah, just down the spaceship forever. It's cool.
Yeah.
So I wasn't as interested in him going home.
Yeah, and it's like there was, you know, they did have that sort of that obligatory scene where he has to face the NASA guys. He's about to get off the spaceship. It's proper crisis point, you know. It looks like the game is up. If he gets off, he's going to go back to the base and he'll be wired up forever. And there, I think, in a typical crisis point, it really does feel like there is no way out, no other option. But I don't know about you, but I felt as he's standing on that last step, there's still the option of going back in. And But then the options are after that aren't clear.
Yeah.
So.
No, and then suddenly that what was not an option, suddenly it's like, oh, okay, let's do that then.
Yeah.
It's not like, it isn't connected in any way to his need, in any way, shape or form.
Yes.
He hasn't gone through any growth that leads to him deciding, okay, I am now going to overcome this obstacle of this internal obstacle to then make this choice that I need to make to get the resolution that I need. It's just like, oh, let's just do this then.
He just gets rewarded.
And so it's less satisfying.
And his need, even though he hasn't earned his need. I think that's possibly what's wrong with that crisis point, is it isn't linked at all to his need.
No.
Oh,
there's no growth that's led to that decision. It's just like, oh, that's the only one left.
Yeah,
I can't stay here because those jerks out there. So,
and I'm not sure.
Vaporization.
I'm not sure how you would connect that crisis point with the need unless there was a threat to Jeff directly. Which of course there isn't. There's no threat to Jeff. There's nothing. There's no brotherly sort of savior moment there.
Yeah, I mean, if Jeff had died as a result of the choices that he made to help David, then going back would save him, potentially, as long as they sorted out the paradox. And so that would be, I will risk death for myself so that then Jeff might not die.
Yeah, to go back.
That would be
a
whole lot stronger, wouldn't it?
That would have been, that definitely would be, you know, if he'd fallen off the roof or, you know, something because of that particular timeline. Because it was a selfish reason of, I'm not staying here because I don't fit here. I don't belong here. This isn't the life I'm choosing. And it doesn't have any direct relationship with his need at all.
No.
Oh, I feel like this has been a really a big unpacking session.
Yeah, but don't make me do it. I'm sad now.
So what are the lessons that we can take away from this?
The thing is that the things that it does well is in terms of the characterization. So the relationship between David and his brother is brilliant, both in 1978 and in 1986. And you see the heart to it all, and you see Jeff grow up and the new relationship that they have, and that's and the parents and the relationship. And the way that they respond, it's all very realistic. And even like the NASA bods, you can understand what they want to do and why they want to do it. I mean, you're annoyed by them, of course, but it's still everyone's motivation and perspective and their personalities, they're very real. And so that I think is a huge strength of this film.
Yeah.
And so it's making sure, because it's very easy to make bad guys one-dimensional, and I don't think that they were one-dimensional. They were just flawed people who had their own motives
and goals, and that so they were just doing their best to follow those. And
I think
the same goes for everyone else.
If you flip the antagonist and the protagonist over, you can see clearly that they are but an antagonist to each other, aren't they? You know, David is antagonizing the NASA guys because you know he's not giving them what they want, really, which is, you know, he's chasing away, and they, you know, he's got that power that they don't have. So in that respect, I think you're right, they are quite carefully constructed. That antagonistic force is equal to the protagonist. And I agree with you, the relationships between each of the characters, the parents, the Sarah Jessica Parker's character and Jeff as they are very strong and very carefully considered. I think that the biggest takeaway, being able to watch this as a screenwriter, as an adult, you know, sort of 30 years since I saw it last, being able to look at it now, definitely taking away that need, the way that need was rewarded without achieving it. It was sort of disingenuously given, I think, is and the way that the second half of the second act just lacks that constant you know, what's the consequence of David not getting home, that wasn't there, that was missing. He could have spent a week flying around in that thing and nothing would have changed. Sort of take, I think are my take homes.
And of
course,
absolutely,
just remembering that this is a really imaginative story, and despite all of those things that we've picked out from it, it still was brilliant for us growing up watching it and evoked a positive emotional reaction still now watching it. And that people can enjoy that without those things being there.
So so there's lots of positives that go away from it. It's just that the actual story structure is just a little bit flat and not properly tied in together, and but it is possible for people to end up loving a story in spite of all those things, as long as you've got plenty of wish fulfillment in there, I imagine.
So I guess big ultimate question is, do you think we should sneak this one into the script department vaults?
I can't
as a screenwriter, would you...
it has to be no, and I'm so sad. It's the first time I've said no, and it's about I feel my love. Can we take the Matrix out and put this in? Just like there's some cosmic balance to that.
Only we can.
Afraid.
I think I am absolutely with you. I think it, on a personal sort of level, I would put this in wholeheartedly. It's a film that I will gladly try and keep alive with you know, younger generations, because of the way that it makes me feel watching it. But as a screenwriter, thinking about the devices and the ways that the film could be improved by tightening up some of it, I do find it difficult compared to some of the other things that we've put in for the reasons we put them in. I find
maybe we should rewrite it and pitch it to Disney, because they're doing all sorts of refilming
sorts
of stories. Let's fix this one. Let's fix it and pitch it to Disney.
Well, perhaps before we pitch it to Disney, we could pitch it to Brad and if we can rewrite this in the Screenwriters Rewatch podcast. Perhaps we could tempt him with that one. Thank you so much for joining me today, Luna. I'm really sorry that this has been a tragic ending for you, for both of us, I think, actually. But it's been really eye-opening to look at a film that has evoked such endearing memories for us, and to realise why this isn't perhaps part of one of the IMDb top 250. But also good to reflect on why it's still considered a good film to each of us, and probably lots of other people. So thank you very much for joining me and for the discussion.
We need to fix
that's the ending to this podcast. Rewrite it.
Let's go have that conversation with Brad. Well, join us next time for another review.
Bye.